Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Greg Luce from the USA. Great to see you, Greg.
You too, Simon. Good to be here.
Great to have you on. So can you introduce yourself to the listeners, please, Greg?
Sure. My name is Gregory Luce. I'm an adult adopted person. I was born and adopted in the District of Columbia in the mid-60s. And today I'm what I consider the only adoptee rights lawyer in the U.S. and I represent adult adopted people on issues related to identity, citizenship, and obtaining records that are often secret.
Yeah. So we were talking. Wow. So you're bringing all you've learned, aren't you? To help others. It's great. I mean, we only have people with big hearts on this show, Greg. So thank you for coming on. So we were talking before about what the theme for today. And I think what you wanted to do was kind of start by talking a little bit about your story, and then we can get into some stuff that you were keen. And the theme was going to be identity and secrecy. Is that?
Yeah, it's sort of identity and secrecy and how they interact or are supported by adoption. And it really kind of grows out of my own story. And my own story really is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I can give you sort of the broad background of what's gone on in my life in the last essentially 20 years.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, thank you.
So I was born in the mid-60s in Washington, D.C. It was a time where there's ultra secrecy around domestic adoption, especially white parents and children. And I didn't think much about my adoption over the years. I knew I was always adopted. There's no time frame where I said, aha, I know I'm adopted. It was just always part of my story. But my life kind of fell apart when I had a child. And within a few months of that child, I was suddenly in DC I remember renting a bike and riding around the town all over the place, trying to sort of imagine where I was for those 7 days when I was born in the city, and then spent some time in a maternity home with my mother. And I found out that at that point I could petition the court to unseal my records. So I thought, oh, this is great. Pay $75 and you file this petition. They give you instructions on how to do it, which I did in the year 2000. And within a few weeks, I got an order back saying, we're unsealing your file, which I thought, great. That was so easy. I'm going to get my records. But it doesn't work that way, and didn't work that way in DC at the time. And what happens is that it was just kicked over to the adoption agency. And then I'm contacted by them saying, well, we need to do a search for your parents and we need to see if they would agree to release your records. And at that time, I was very new into, you know, figuring out who I was, and I was not interested in a search. And I certainly couldn't afford the $500 fee at the time.
Wow.
Which is pretty typical.
A lot of money.
In the US. So I sort of let it go. I didn't do anything. But at the same time, my birth mother, right around that same time, had registered with one of these private online registries. They're all over the place where you can just sign up, say when you gave birth to a child or when you were born as an adopted person. And if there's luck has it, you can be matched. And luck did have it for me. And in October of 2000, suddenly I got an email from this registry administrator saying, I think we've got a match. They confirmed it. And voila, there was my reunion within, you know, I think a week, essentially, I was talking to her on the phone. And so I did get to meet her. I flew to Florida where she lived at the time. She unfortunately had been battling cancer for 13 years and died about 6 months after we were reunited. So it was a very bittersweet reunion. I am lucky in that way. And I'm close to her family still today. And so that's something that's really
Yeah.
wonderful for me. So sort of as adoption things go, I mean, I knew who my, at that point, I knew who my birth father was. He wasn't interested in meeting because she told me who, what his name was. But as adoption things go with me and for many people, it was another 15 years before I really did anything. I mean, I was raising a kid, I was busy with, you know, work, but it's always in the back of your mind. And so in 2015 or so, I was sort of in between what, trying to figure out what work to do next. And I said, you know, I'm going to try to get my birth certificate again. I know all the information. It seems dumb not to give it to me. And I filed a court case. And this time, as you know, I was a lawyer. I said, I'm just going to throw the book at everything. I'm just going to file a 35-page memorandum of law, a 20-page petition, and I'm just going to take it up to as high of a court I can go to get what I think is mine. And that's what happened. I was denied originally by the court, and then I made them reconsider it. And then when they reconsidered it, they said, you can have all your records, but we're going to redact your father's name from those records. And so I got all the records, and since I knew who he was, every time they redacted the information, I just had to fill in the name. So it's just really stupid. So I said, I appealed that, said, you know, I should get my original birth certificate unredacted. And that went up on appeal to the DC Court of Appeals, and I won. They said I did deserve it. It should be unredacted. And it got sent back to the court. And right at that, the last hearing I had was the day they, in last year, actually, the day they instituted a state of emergency in DC because of COVID-19. And then, so it took some time, and I finally got my original unredacted birth certificate in November of 2020. So it's not too long ago, less than a year ago that I got it. And it was very meaningful to receive that, that record, even though I knew all the information on it. It was verification, unveiling and getting rid of secrecy, but at the same time took me an immense amount of effort to do that. And an effort that the vast majority of adoptees don't have the wherewithal, the money, the stamina sometimes to go through a court case like that. So along those lines, when I was doing this in 2015 through about 2020, I said, you know, I'm gonna look around the US and see if this is true everywhere. And it was true in most states in the US. There's only 10 now where you can request your original birth certificate and actually receive it without any other restrictions. And so from that, it grew my legal practice, the Adoptee Rights Law Center, where I represent adult adopted people who want to get their birth records or have US citizenship issues if they're intercountry adoptees, or have identity issues that they need documents to secure or confirm their identity. And that's what I do today. And I also track legislation in the US, and I get involved in legislative work to change the laws in various states.
Yeah.
So it's all surrounded around identity and secrecy, and how adoption uses those, or how adoption hides identity through secrecy. And that's what my work involves.
Yeah. Did your birth mother give you a name?
She did. It was not on the birth record, but she did. I did have a name that she used for me. And I had a last name, obviously, because it was her last name.
Yeah.
It wasn't my father's last name. But he was on the birth record as well.
Wow. Because here in the UK, so if you're listening to this in the UK, or you want to find out more about these registers that Greg's talking about, check out the podcast episode with a guy called Paul Field. I did one. He's a webmaster. He's an adoptee as well, a UK adoptee who now lives in the States. And he runs one of these registries. So like today's show is mainly obviously going to be focused around from the legal perspective. We're going to be looking at from the US, but if you want some input on the UK and want to find out the issue, check out this Paul Field. Episode. So I remember I got my original birth certificate, which didn't actually look like a birth certificate at all, or what I thought was going to look, but it had my birth mother's name on it. And here in the UK, if you're born before 1975, You can't get that unless you go and see a counsellor that works for an adoption, a post-adoption support agency, or some sort of counsellor. So I went through that. That was the hoop that I had to go through, and I got this form, and it said it had my birth mother's name on it, and. Unfortunately, when I went further on to find it, she had died. She died of cancer as well, but before I start, a long time before I started search. So you had that 6 months. But what I saw was this David. I'm, you know, like you're talking to Simon Jonathan Ben here, but I was David Anthony Flower.
Yeah, I was Brian.
You were Brian.
Yeah.
And I that was a little bit weird to me. Did it feel weird to you?
No, because I always wanted to know if I had a name. It was very affirming to me that I was actually named. I wasn't an unnamed child. Yeah, I think that was incredibly important to me. And there's a lot of adoptees who have no name on their original birth certificate. It could be baby girl, and then a last name. So yeah, it was very meaningful to have that. It wasn't on my birth record, but it was clearly part of all the other records. I was lucky. I got not only my birth record released from the Department of Health, but I got the entire court file, and I got the thing that is the hardest thing to get is the adoption agency files. And that's about 80 pages of notes, of interviews, of data on both adoptive parents and the birth parents. And so you get to see the progress of how this adoption occurred, and I still have that, and it was very meaningful to have it. It's the hardest ones ever to get. Yeah. In fact, I rarely, on behalf of clients, am able to get the adoption agency files. And even if I do get an order for the adoption agency files, the adoption agency is very reluctant to give out anything, and they often will redact information in the files.
Wow. Yeah, I went through two stages. So my first stage was my original birth certificate, and then I stopped. I didn't do any more. I didn't do any searching. And then I don't know how much longer it was after that, a year ago, 2 years, that sort of magnitude. Then I got my file. And in my file, I got like the adoption agency records that you're talking about. You could see the whole thing happening,
right?
And that was there was one particular document in there that really helped me. It was about this the teddy bear that I'd found out at 40 was from a birth mother, and I had this violent reaction of anger towards my birth mother. And then 9 years later, when I finally did all the search, I got the adoption file with a letter to the adoption agency from my birth mother saying, could she buy me this teddy bear? So that was, you know, one of the big hidden gems in my file. Were there any hidden gems in your file that you found from
I consider so many hidden gems in there just because I have the info, but the one that really stood out to me was I was switched at the very end to different adoptive parents. So close to when I was finally adopted, I went to my current parents instead of this other set of parents, which I'll probably never know. My birth parents weren't informed of that. So they thought I was going to this other person. The only thing I know about this other family is that the father would take the local kids out to the baseball games. It must've been the Washington Nationals or the Senators at that point. And my birth parents thought that was great that he's so involved in taking the local neighborhood kids to baseball games, but that wasn't the father that I ultimately had. And so that was one of those things that really encapsulates adoption for me, is that there is a sort of randomness to it as well, or sort of your fate can be switched so quickly and easily.
Yeah.
Replacement. And my life would have been completely different with this other adoptive family.
Yeah.
I may not have moved to Oklahoma like I did at 3 years of age. And so that was sort of the gym.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the eye opener, I think.
Yeah.
Clearly. But otherwise, I mean, I had known much of the information already since I was pretty close to my birth mother's family. And, you know, I dug deep into ancestry.com and had public records, you know, going back hundreds of years, really. So it's fairly easy to find my birth father's information. I'm, for what it's worth, directly related to Martha Dandridge, George Washington's wife, is a great grandmother. And so is his. So is his sister, Betty Washington, is also a grandmother of mine. So I have American royalty, I guess, in my blood.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. So with that kind of public record, I can trace the lineages pretty far back. Yeah.
What was the word you used? It wasn't persistence. You used a word earlier on. You talked about most adoptees wouldn't have the wherewithal.
Yeah, the wherewithal, just the energy or the stamina.
Stamina.
It's because it does take stamina, and that's why I like doing the lawyer stuff, because it takes some of that burden off. And I've learned, you know, fairly well now how to move within the courts, and I can tell clients. And mostly, it's all Minnesota based. I live in Minnesota now. Minnesota-based clients, but you know, I can tell you what, you know, yes, this is what you're going to probably get. This is what we need. And I've been successful in every case so far. And there's dozens that I've had.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, the legislature doesn't quite get it. In Minnesota, especially in many other states, they lock down on secrecy. They feel that promises were made to birth parents years ago, which isn't true. And so the legislators don't like to do much, but when I present the facts to a judge in a court and they take a look at those facts, they, for the most part, almost always release the records. They don't see, there is no secrecy. There is no promise of anonymity. And, you know, it's not hard to convince a judge that that's true.
Yeah.
And then so they release the records. And you know, and I have fascinating cases that pop up all the time. You know, I have a few late discovery adoptees. Those are easy to get records because there was deception in the very beginning. I even have a case now where the client was reunited with a birth mother from the records that were given to her by the agency, but that was not her birth mother. And she had a relationship with that person for decades. And it's found out just recently that's not her. So someone made a mistake along the way. And we're trying to find that out.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Nuts.
That all goes into the whole bucket of secrecy. When it's ultra secret here in the US and most states, you have all sorts of things that come out of that that often are not good, that often make it, you know, you feel shameful in some ways for requesting your own birth record. Like you're not supposed to have it. And so getting it is actually, there's two things with that. One is information, and two is the verification of your existence. I mean, we obviously exist in the world. I'm, you know, flesh and blood right now, but it's verification, and that you were born on this day to this person in this city. And I think that's very important very important for many, many adopted people to have that verification that, yes, you're going to give it to me. You're not going to hide it from me anymore because I am human.
Yeah. Wow. This is existential stuff. I wanted to take you back just a couple of minutes to, you know, why you get the results that you do. I guess your name is your name on the, as the solicitor, the attorney. We'd use the word solicitor in the UK. Your name's on the papers. So when they see it's you. Mm-hmm. They know that they're up against somebody that knows his onions. So they're going to roll over, you know.
Right. No, there's two things to that, really. I mean, some do know my name. There's 77 counties in Minnesota, so there's 77 different places where I'd have to petition. Oh, wow. Yeah, wow. It's kind of crazy how it's all decentralized. And that's how adoption works in the U.S. It's very decentralized. It goes down to the county level, essentially, because that's the county level is where you would have the adoption case. State level, if it's the birth certificate itself, but state level for the adoption records. But so some judges know me, some clerks know me. But the most important thing was, ironically, or fortuitously from my perspective, when I named it Adoptee Rights Law Center, that's the thing I think really people look, oh, holy cow, there's an actual law center that's dedicated to adoptee rights. This person must know his stuff, and they're not going to give up. And so I think it feels good to say that. It feels good to have a business card that has Adoptee Rights Law Center. You give it to someone and they say, oh, okay. There's someone fighting for rights here. I better get my ducks in a row. They kind of assume that you know what you're talking about. I don't always know what I'm talking about, but they kind of assume that.
Yeah, we have there's a varnish, wood seal varnish here in the UK, and their advert used to be so Ron Seal wood seal varnish. It does what it says on the tin.
Yeah,
so, you know, when you're the Adoptee Rights Law Center, you do what.
I think what happens is I'm not some attorney that's taking a case pro bono for a client who is a friend, you know, and just my law firm, it was just the name of me as the law firm. I think a lot of judges or court clerks or others would think that, but then when they see it as Adoptee Rights Law Center, then they know it's very focused. They know what you should know what you're doing. And obviously there's some expertise behind it. I was very clear in naming it that way, and I think the first blog post I ever did for the website was, "I am not an adoption attorney," because I'm not. I don't do adoptions. I do adoptee rights law, and which is very different.
I used to deal. I used to sell to big corporations here in the UK, including American. The UK offshoots of American organizations like. McDonald's and Coca-Cola and people like that. We once did a deal with Enron, funnily enough. We got paid. They were the trickiest people, before they went bust. They were the trickiest people in the history of our business. I had a small team of five, but I was writing to chief executives, and I used to call myself managing director. And I thought, well, then people like to deal with at the same level, don't they? So I gave myself a promotion to chief executive. So I was a chief executive writing to the chief executives. But obviously somebody like a UK company, like Walmart own Asda, right? So Asda is the third biggest supermarket chain in the UK. They might have like 200,000 staff, something like that. So I would write as the chief executive of a publishing business with five staff to the chief executive of Asda UK with 200,000. But, you know, we're just the same guys, you know. I'm a chief executive, you're a chief executive. You just have 995 extra clients than me. So it is all in the name, guys. It's all in the name.
Well, yeah, and I think, in some very strange way, that's why the name was so important to me to have a name. It's because it made it more human that I was acknowledged in some. That's probably the best way to say it. I was acknowledged.
Acknowledged, yeah. Yeah. Well, you talked about verification and verification. So people that I come across in the adoption space, who are really struggling, not the sorts of people that would come on the show, but people that I see in Facebook groups, they are rudderless. They are rudderless. Their foundations, like their foundations of themselves, the self of their self-esteem, mm-hmm. is very well, almost non-existent. You know, they are looking for validation,
right?
That they exist. You know, but I think we all need that validation.
Yeah, I think most of my clients have had to work through that initial rudderless part to get to the point of where they contact me to help with records. I think that's sort of an end result of, you know, finding your own power and then operating on that power. Yeah. Or finding whatever power you have and using that to find out more information. So I think, I mean, it's in some ways, it's why I kind of can't answer the phone. I really can't, because one, you know, I'm just a one person shop. And two, if I were to answer the phone, I would be talking to people about that rudderlessness all the time and working through their issues, which is, I'm not an expert at doing that. And unfortunately, I don't have the time to do it. So I can't answer my phone. Also, because as you know, with all adoptees, they want to tell you their entire genealogical story. And suddenly I'm on the phone 4 hours a day learning about people's genealogical roots.
Yeah.
And I really just need to know the basic facts and what I can do to help them to get their records. But yeah, I think those people who contact me generally have moved through that rudderlessness. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we started recording, I said that I recorded a podcast with Joe Sol yesterday. He said, well, you know, some people won't go near this stuff because they're, you know, it's too scary.
Right.
You know, he was talking more about the emotional stuff. It's too scary. So people will put their head in the sand or the finger in their ears and whistle very loudly and hope that it will go away. And those aren't the sorts that they're at that stage in the journey when they're not going to be doing any.
Right. And, you know, I think that's why it's useful that I'm also an adopted person, because I've been there. I've been, I'm sure, rudderless and related in some ways to adoption. And I know what it's like to try to get your records. I know how meaningful those records are. So I do provide guidance in that whole process. And the people trust you because, you know, I mean, it's been important. Many clients say it's very important to me that you are also adopted because you get it. Because we're also juggling like all these different issues. And I understand how emotional it can be. You're juggling this issue of, should I find that information and am I going to disappoint my adoptive parents? How should I tell them? I don't even know what's on the other end of this whole search or what names I'm going to find, if any. Maybe I won't get anything. And then you've got societal sort of things telling you that, at least in the U.S., you really shouldn't be looking at all, because we often hear your adoptive parents are your, quote, real parents. And what are you doing? Why are you doing that? You should keep this secret. And it's that embedded secrecy that I think is so hard for people to make the decision to say, screw this. Those are my own records and that's my life. And I should have that. And I should do with it what I please.
Say that, I mean, the secrecy and the shame and the that whole cocktail, nasty cocktail, is just very disempowering. Have you come across a guy called Richard Hawkins? He's got a scale of human consciousness from 0 to 1,000.
From 1 to 1,000?
From 0 to 1,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have not. Where are you? Are you in the like 800s or so?
Well, sometimes Sometimes I'm 20. 20 is shame.
Oh, so they've named these. That's interesting.
Ish, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so I can see that you're sort of going up. People are going up and down and up and down.
They are, yeah. But it's fascinating. It's a fascinating... he calls it the hidden determinants of human behavior.
Hmm.
I find it fascinating because it is. So there's a logic here that, you know, something that happened to us. So we're the same kind of vintage, mid 50s. Yeah. So I was adopted in 67. What you said, mid 60s.
Yeah, I was in 65.
65, yeah. So you're a couple of years older than me. So similar vintage, right? So something, yeah, it's a historic event that's happened, and our experience is variable. It's not static, is it? As human beings, nobody has a static experience,
right?
In terms of their mood. So I'm using mood as a kind of an easy word instead of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So our mood has been up and down. Everybody's mood goes up and down, as you said, moods go up and down. Well, so we've got a moving target of our mood, and we've got a static event. So a static event in the past that happened 50 odd years ago cannot cause a moving mood. So people say that I'm like this because I'm adopted. Well, they're not always like that. So let's take shyness, right, or insecure. You said to me, where am I at about 800? And I said, I joked, I said, I'm about, 20 for shame. But I have been in that. I have been in that shame place of 20.
Right.
And I have been a lot higher. I've been angry. Anger's about, I can't remember, anger's 50 or 150, something like that. So I had a lot of anger. But my mood has gone up and down. So it can't actually be the adoption. It's actually down to my mood. Does that make any sense?
I could see that it's not an answer. I could see that it's certainly impacts where you may be at a certain point in your life.
Yeah.
I mean, some of us have worked through it. Some haven't. I mean, you talk about rudderless folks. I think that still impacts them, or in whatever way, whether they think about it all the time, or whether it's there's a transracial element to it that impacts it greatly than not. I can see that there's still an impact. I think there's a lifelong impact with adoption. I do. I mean, I look at my brother sometimes, though. He was adopted to different biological parents, and from what I can tell, he never thinks about it. Never thinks about adoption. It doesn't want to. It's not that he's opposed to thinking about it. That's his life, and he's good enough right now.
Yeah.
I don't know when he's 70 whether it's going to change, or 80 when it's going to change, or if it's going to change at all.
Yeah.
My guess is that the vast majority of adopted people are pretty comfortable with being adopted. It's a smaller number who are not. And for whatever reason, I don't know. This is what I don't know, is it impacts them greatly than others. I think about it a lot. I mean, it's partially my work, but I still think about how I act in just day to day. Not that fine-tuned, but how issues impact me, and whether that's, I ask whether this is related to adoption. I think I joke around too, and I think you probably do and others do, and you joke around that it's all about adoption. It's like, I do this because, I mean, I have a stomach pain because of adoption. I have my eye twitches because of adoption. No, I don't believe in all that. But yeah, I mean, so that's, I think that's always a little bit much. But, yeah. I'll take people as they are and however they feel that they're impacted by adoption and go from there. And so I use my brother as a sort of my control group. and look at him and say, well, I guess he's got it. He's not neither good nor bad. He's just, that's his experience.
So,
but it's interesting, the conscious, I'll have to look that up. I want to see where, how up and down I go in that sort of 1,000 points of consciousness.
Yeah. And it's for me, the scale of consciousness, the scale of consciousness is a learning curve.
Oh yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, especially as we age. I mean, as we age, we kind of get rid of all the bullshit, and you concentrate on things that really matter.
Yeah,
it seems that way to me.
Yeah, so sometimes we do. So you've got obviously oversimplifying it. You know, you've got wise men,
mm-hmm.
wise women. And then you've got, then we have this in the UK, it's been a thing for a while. Grumpy old man, you know, like,
yeah,
grumpy old man. So some people get wiser and some people get grumpier, you know, that's different learning curves. I think, what do they say? It's about, our neuroplasticity gets more brittle, does it? It gets more fixed. We're more set in our ways. We're more set in our views of the world. We're more set in our ways because how we see the world determines,
right.
You know, what we do. And I'm pretty determined not to become one of those grumpy old men.
Oh yeah, I'm totally determined in that, but I don't know if I can help it. That's what I'm afraid of. It's like all I want to do is sit on the sofa out on the back deck and read, you know, and get set in my ways. But
yeah,
especially after the legislative seasons here, when it's been so hectic and anxiety driven. Yeah. But yeah, I mean,
talking about legislation, are you dry? Is your stuff starting to drive change at all? Are people, you know, we hear about law is, what I hear about law is largely, you know, determined by what I see on the TV. So, you know, we hear about test cases, you know, John Grisham. There's the John Grisham films. There's LA Law from the 80s, all shoulder pads and design addressing, and you know, and then there's what else was there? Oh, there's The Good Fight, the spin-off from The Good Wife, set in Chicago. So we hear about these test cases so all the class actions and stuff like that. That's how I see that's what I take of the law. Are the stuff that you're driving in the 70 counties of Minnesota, is that starting to change anything, or is everything still done very piecemeal?
Well, in Minnesota, it's done piecemeal. In most places, it depends. I mean, if you want adoption court files, that's piecemeal, because that's going to be in the county where the adoptive parents lived at the time of the adoption. Unless you change the law and they centralize those files, which they won't. But if you're talking about the birth record, that's state by state. And so that's part of the issue of having a decentralized vital records system in the US. We actually have 52 different registration areas, because DC is one and New York City has its own too. So you got 52 different places that have birth certificates, and that doesn't count the territories of the US either. And so you've got 52 places.
Yeah, where's, wow.
What's that?
You know, I look at stuff on the States, you know, look at states and the states, the United States, and I hear this word Guam, like,
right.
Where's Guam? Where's
it's in the Pacific, yeah.
The Pacific.
It's the territory. And I think the territories, and I know Puerto Rico, there's a way to get your original birth record in Puerto Rico. And I think Guam is also one that you can obtain your birth record as well. I need to add the territories to my website, actually.
Yeah.
But so you have all these, you know, territories are states, and so it's decentralized, and you're gonna have to go state by state by state if you're gonna do legislation. unless you can get federal legislation on that issue. And because it's such a state's issue, it's going to be unlikely you're going to get a federal law to change how vital records are handled. Yeah. Unless you link it to some sort of funding mechanism. So meaning like the government gives a ton of money to states for facilitating adoptions, especially those out of foster care. If they were to link that to say, we will give you money unless, we're not gonna give you money unless your records are available to the adoptee at age 18, that could influence all of the states. But I don't see that happening in the near future. And then you talk about, so that's state level legislation to change, you know, how to get your original birth record. Court cases are going to be a lot harder to bring in and will take years to do, but it is something that I look for all the time. You just have to, as you say, the test case, you have to have the right case. You have to have a case that will raise the issues that you need raised, that has a good chance of being successful. And importantly, you have a client that's willing to go the full measure, because it can be an exhausting process for a client to, as I've learned myself in my own case, to go 5, 6, 7, 8 years on a court case, not knowing how it's gonna turn out.
Yeah.
So that's how difficult the legal court changing it by law, but changing it by a court case will be as compared to changing it state by state by state.
Yeah.
I think we are making progress at state legislation. I think partially the issue often is influenced by how old the legislators are. Those that are older are sort of locked into the mythology of adoption that existed in the US in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And they want to retain that mythology of you know, protecting the mother from the stigma of being unmarried with the child. And as those legislators age out, we're seeing much more amenability to changing the law. Younger legislators get it. Older legislators, some do, some don't.
Yeah. And it's not stuck in
the... Often the older legislators have the power because they've been there longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they're the ones...
that's how I break it down.
That's how I break it down. So this secrecy that you're talking about is... It isn't part of the ingredient of that secrecy is this opacity in the fact you've got 52 states. So if they've all got 70 counties, then that's 3,500 counties.
Yeah.
And then they've got the court files, and then you've got 52 states with the birth records. It's all very disjointed, hard to navigate, opaque system.
Extremely frustrating. Yeah, it's extremely demeaning to try to navigate that, because often you're just told over and over and over, you can't have that, can't have that. That's not yours. And so people give up, or they turn to DNA, and that's the best they can do. You know, for some, DNA is fine. They find a name and it's the reunion that they're after, or just the name. But for many people, I found it's really the documentation of that, sort of what we talked about earlier about verification or confirmation or acknowledgement in a government record that, yes, this was you at that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that's so decentralized. And that's just the system that we have. Yours must be federalized in some ways. Your record is held it's like in Ireland. Ireland's having a debate right now, and all the records are held by a central authority. So that's very useful, because you just apply to one place.
So I went through, there's one central register, actually. The birth records are federal, because they're all right. By federal, I mean England, actually, not Ireland and Scotland, right. Scotland and Wales, or Northern Ireland. I think that's pretty sure. I think there's one organisation that have different offices, but funnily enough, the office where you write to for the birth records is in Blackpool, where my birth mother was from.
That's just a coincidence.
Yeah. So in the UK, you know, you are the United States of America. We are the United Kingdom. So that our, you know, if you said that England is a kingdom and, you know, Scotland is a kingdom, whatever, you know, it's clearly not, but they've got more power. So what we call counties are kind of equivalent to your states. So I live in North Yorkshire, right? So you could say, well, that's the equivalent to North Carolina, right? Or North Dakota. But North Yorkshire has far less power than North Dakota. So North Dakota will set its own state taxes. We don't have county taxes. We have some property taxes, but basically a lot more power is devolved, and right. What you call the states have far more power than what we call our counties. And your counties, your equivalent of counties, are the sub level of the
what? Right. Yeah. It's devolved is a good word to use in the U.S. That power is for our birth records is in the states.
Yeah.
So the power for the court records is in the county. Yeah.
So the opacity and the complexity of the system is a crucial part, a crucial ingredient within the kind of the secrecy mix. I guess.
And partially too is that, you know, you can't, in many states, you can't even find out if you were adopted. You can't even apply to, we have to apply to find that information out. And sometimes you have to apply and show all sorts of identification just to get confirmation of where the court case was. It's so secret that finding out that you were adopted is actually a secret. I mean, it's crazy.
It is, you know, to what extent is that bureaucratic? The bureaucracies want to control stuff. And to what extent is that a shame thing that's kind of, it's built into the system to make it difficult to avoid pain further on to the birth mother's
infant? It was developed and grew from shame, and whether they slowly discard that is the big question now. And I'm seeing changes. I mean, I feel that when I interact with a court clerk or an attorney for the county, I get more, I'm not as dismissed as quickly as I used to be. Not because I'm an attorney, but on the issue of adoption records, they're not as dismissive. In fact, I often talk to court clerks who are adopted themselves, and they'll ask me questions, or they, you know, they have a brother or sister who's adopted, and they'll ask me questions as well. I mean, it happens more frequently than I thought it would. But I think that has, again, as I go back to sort of, it's rooted in shame and secrecy, and we need to grow out of that. And I think we are. And I think what I don't have my finger on right now is youth adopted people and what their issues are. Those who are, you know, 15, 16 through mid 20s, and what they're thinking about, what their issues are. For the most part, not always, they're more open adoption, yet their records are going to be sealed. So at some point, and I do think about this quite a bit, at some point, how do we transition as a political group to be much more inclusive to those who are young, much younger, and incorporate and understand and support what issues they have, which are probably very different than ours. I mean, I'm also the president of Adoptees United, which is a national nonprofit here in the U.S. As we determine what it means to be adopted in the United States and what those issues are. And so it is, I think there is both this aging out of legislators, but also an aging out of adopted people and the domination of what they feel are the issues for all adopted people. That's, I think, in the US, it's interesting. You're gonna find the most vocal adoptees, for the most part, I mean, this is very general, are white older women. I mean, there's very few male adoptees in the US that are very active in legislative work or other adoptee rights issues. It's mostly driven, very generally again, by right now white older women. And that needs to change because that's not representative adoption anymore. But it is what's driving who was adopted back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So we're still defined by that era, very much so. And we need to break out of that and be defined by our own, I would say, power to tell our own stories and to have the information that we need to have an accurate story. And that's, I think, where we're headed, I hope.
Yeah. Fingers crossed, yeah. Yeah. That feels like a good place to bring it in, right? So I'll put a link obviously in the show notes to Greg's website and some links to him on social so people can get in touch if they want to explore this further with you.
Sure.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it was a good talk.
Fascinating. Sure. Fascinating discussion, you know, flipping between UK, the emotional and the legal, the UK mm-hmm. versus the US. The shame versus the systemization,
right?
And that I'm sure the listeners have enjoyed it. Okay. The ones that are listening this far must have enjoyed it. The ones that thought, "What is this guy on?" I mean, right, me, exactly. Not you, clearly.
What the hell is this guy on for? Yeah,
you know, why is he talking? Yeah, why is he talking about David Hawkins' power level of consciousness? Yeah. Thanks a lot.
I enjoyed it. It's always fun to talk. I always like, I'm pretty introverted, and so I kind of don't look forward to these, but when I do them, I really like them. Yeah.
Good on you. All see right. You soon. Thanks a lot, listeners.
Yeah, take care, Simon.